much as the first step into the unexplored. Thus the sailors of the bold vessels of Columbus, breaking the horizon of the medieval mind, sailing, as they thought, into the boundless ocean of immortal being that surrounds the cosmos, like an endless mythological serpent biting its tail, had to be cozened and urged on like children, because of their fear of the fabled leviathans, mermaids, dragon kings, and other monsters of the deep. The folk mythologies populate with deceitful and dangerous presences every desert place outside the normal traffic of the village. For example, the Hottentots describe an ogre that has been occasionally encountered among the scrubs and dunes. Its eyes are set on its instep, so that to discover what is going on, it has to get down on hands and knees and hold up one foot. The eye then looks behind, otherwise it is gazing continually at the sky. This monster is a hunter of men, whom it tears to shreds with cruel teeth as long as fingers. The creature is said to hunt in packs. Another Hottentot apparition, the Hiuri, progresses by leaping over clumps of scrub instead of going around them. A dangerous, one-legged, one-armed, one-sided figure, the half-man, invisible if viewed from the offside, is encountered in many parts of the earth. In Central Africa, it is declared that such a half-man says to the person who has encountered him, "Since you have met with me, let us fight together." If thrown, he will plead, "Do not kill me! I will show you lots of medicines." And then the lucky person becomes a proficient doctor. But if the half-man, called Chiruwi, a mysterious thing, wins, his victim dies. The regions of the unknown, desert, jungle, deep sea, alien land, etc., are free fields for the projection of unconscious content. Incestuous libido and patricidal destrudo are thence reflected back against the individual and his society in forms suggesting threats of violence and fancied dangerous delight, not only as ogres, but also as sirens of mysteriously seductive, nostalgic beauty. The Russian peasants know, for example, of the wild women of the woods, who have their abode in mountain caverns where they maintain households like human beings. They are handsome females, with fine square heads, abundant tresses, and hairy bodies. They fling their breasts over their shoulders when they run, and when they nurse their children. They go in groups. With unguents prepared from forest roots, they can anoint and render themselves invisible. They like to dance or tickle people to death who wander alone into the forest, and anyone who accidentally chances upon their invisible dancing parties dies. On the other hand, for people who set out food for them, they reap the grain, spin, care for the children, and tidy up the house. And if a girl will comb out hemp for them to spin, they will give her leaves that turn to gold. They enjoy human lovers, have frequently married country youths, and are known to make excellent wives. But like all supernatural brides, the minute the husband offends in the least their whimsical notions of marital propriety, they disappear without a trace. One more example to illustrate the libidinous association of the dangerous impish ogre with the principle of seduction is Dedushka Vodyanoy, the Russian water grandfather. He is an adroit shapeshifter and is said to drown people who swim at midnight or at noon. Drowned or disinherited girls he marries. He has a special talent for coaxing unhappy women into his toils. He likes to dance on moonlit nights. Whenever a wife of his is about to have a baby, he comes into the villages to seek a midwife. but he can be detected by the water that oozes from the border of his garments. He is bald, tun-bellied, puffy-cheeked, with green clothing and a tall cap of reeds. But he can also appear as an attractive young man, or as some personage well known in the community. This watermaster is not strong ashore, but in his own element he is supreme. He inhabits the deeps of rivers, streams, and ponds, preferring to be close beside a mill. During the day he remains concealed, like an old trout or salmon, but at night he surfaces, splashing and flopping like a fish, to drive his subaqueous cattle, sheep, and horses ashore to graze, or else to perch up on the mill wheel and quietly comb his long green hair and beard. In the springtime, when he rouses from his long hibernation, he smashes the ice along the rivers, piling up great blocks. Mill wheels he is amused to destroy. But in a favorable temper, he drives his fish herds into the fisherman's net or gives warning of coming floods. The midwife who accompanies him he pays richly with silver and gold. His beautiful daughters, tall, pale, and with an air of sadness, transparently costumed in green, torture and torment the drowned. They like to rock on trees, beautifully singing. The Arcadian god Pan is the best-known classical example of this dangerous presence dwelling just beyond the protected zone of the village boundary. Silvanus and Faunus were his Latin counterparts. In Alexandrian times, Pan was identified with the Ithyphallic Egyptian divinity Min, who was, among other things, the guardian of desert roads. Pan was the inventor of the shepherd's pipe, which he played for the dances of the nymphs, and the satyrs were his male companions. The emotion that he instilled in human beings who by accident adventured into his domain was panic fear, a sudden, groundless fright. Any trifling cause, then, the break of a twig, the flutter of a leaf, would flood the mind with imagined danger, and in the frantic effort to escape from his own aroused unconscious, the victim expired in a flight of dread. Yet Pan was benign to those who paid him worship, yielding the boons of the divine hygiene of nature, bounty to the farmers, herders, and fisherfolk who dedicated their first fruits to him, and health to all who properly approached his shrines of healing. Also wisdom, the wisdom of Omphalos, the world navel, was his to bestow, for the crossing of the threshold is the first step into the sacred zone of the universal source. At Lycaon was an oracle, presided over by the nymph Erato, whom Pan inspired, as Apollo the prophetess at Delphi. And Plutarch numbers the ecstasies of the orgiastic rites of Pan, along with the ecstasy of Cybele, the Bacchic frenzy of Dionysus, the poetic frenzy inspired by the Muses, the warrior frenzy of the god Ares, equals Mars, and, fiercest of all, the frenzy of love, as illustrations of that divine enthusiasm that overturns the reason and releases the forces of the destructive creative dark. I dreamed, stated a middle-aged married gentleman.
I dreamed that I wanted to get into a wonderful garden, but before it there was a watchman who would not permit me to enter. I saw that my friend, Fraulein Elsa, was within. She wanted to reach me her hand over the gate. But the watchman prevented that, took me by the arm and conducted me home. Do be sensible, after all, he said. You know that you mustn't do that. The watchman symbolizes, according to Wilhelm Steckel, consciousness, or, if one prefers, the aggregate of all the morality and restrictions present in consciousness. Freud, continues Dr. Steckel, would describe the watchman as the superego, but he is really only an interego. Consciousness prevents the breaking through of dangerous wishes and immoral actions. This is the sense in which watchmen, police officials and officers in dreams are in general to be interpreted.
This is a dream that brings out the sense of the first or protective aspect of the threshold guardian. One had better not challenge the watcher of the established bounds. And yet, it is only by advancing beyond those bounds, provoking the other destructive aspect of the same power, that the individual passes, either alive or in death, into a new zone of experience. In the language of the Pygmies of the Andaman Islands, the word Okojumu, dreamer, one who speaks from dreams, designates those highly respected and feared individuals who are distinguished from their fellows by the possession of supernatural talents, which can be acquired only by meeting with the spirits, directly in the jungle, through extraordinary dream, or by death and return. The adventure is always and everywhere a passage beyond the veil of the known, into the unknown. The powers that watch at the boundary are dangerous. To deal with them is risky. Yet for anyone with competence and courage, the danger fades. In the Banks Islands of the New Hebrides, if a young man coming back from his fishing on a rock towards sunset chances to see
a girl with her head bedecked with flowers beckoning to him from the slope of the cliff up which his path is leading him, he recognizes the countenance of some girl of his own or a neighboring village. He stands and hesitates and thinks she must be a Mai. He looks more closely and observes that her elbows and knees bend the wrong way. This reveals her true character, and he flies. If a young man can strike the temptress with a dracaena leaf, she turns into her own shape and glides away a snake.
But these very snakes, the Mai, amphibious sea snakes marked with bands of dark and light color, so greatly feared, are believed to become the familiars of those who have intercourse with them. Such demons, at once dangers and bestowers of magic power, every hero must encounter who steps an inch outside the walls of his tradition. Two vivid Oriental stories will serve to illuminate the ambiguities of this perplexing pass and show how, though the terrors will recede before a genuine psychological readiness, the overbold adventurer beyond his depth may be shamelessly undone. The first is of a caravan leader from Benares, who made bold to conduct his richly loaded expedition of 500 carts into a waterless demon wilderness. Forewarned of dangers, he had taken the precaution to set huge chatties filled with water in the carts, so that, rationally considered, his prospect of making the passage of not more than 60 desert leagues was of the best. But when he had reached the middle of the crossing, the ogre who inhabited that wilderness thought, "I will make these men throw away the water they took." So he created a cart to delight the heart, drawn by pure white young oxen, the wheels smeared with mud, and came down the road from the opposite direction. Both before him and behind marched the demons who formed his retinue, heads wet, garments wet, decked with garlands of water lilies, both blue and white, carrying in their hands clusters of lotus flowers, both red and white, chewing the fibrous stalks of water lilies, streaming with drops of water and mud. And when the caravan and the demon company drew aside to let each other pass, the ogre greeted the leader in a friendly manner. "Where are you going?" he politely asked. To which the caravan leader replied, "We, sir, are coming from Benares. But you are approaching decked with water lilies, both blue and white, with lotus flowers both red and white in your hands, chewing the fibrous stalks of water lilies, smeared with mud, with drops of water streaming from you. Is it raining along the road by which you came? Are the lakes completely covered with water lilies, both blue and white, and lotus flowers both red and white? The ogre. Do you see that dark green streak of woods? Beyond that point, the entire forest is one mass of water. It rains all the time. The hollows are full of water. Everywhere are lakes completely covered with lotus flowers, both red and white. And then, as the carts passed, one after another, he inquired, "What goods do you have in this cart? And in that? The last moves very heavily. What goods do you have in that?" "We have water in that," the leader answered. "You have acted wisely, of course, in bringing water thus far. But beyond this point, you have no occasion to burden yourself. Break the chatties to pieces. Throw away the water. Travel at ease." The ogre went his way, and when out of sight, returned again to his own city of ogres. Now that caravan leader, out of his own foolishness, took the advice of the ogre, broke the chatties, and caused the carts to move forward. Ahead, there was not the slightest particle of water. For lack of water to drink, the men grew weary. They traveled until sundown, and then unharnessed the carts, drew them up in a contracted circle, and tied the oxen to the wheels. There was neither water for the oxen, nor gruel and boiled rice for the men. The weakened men lay down, here and there, and went to sleep. At midnight, the ogres approached from the city of ogres, slew the oxen and men, every one, devoured their flesh, leaving only the bare bones, and having so done, departed. The bones of their hands and all their other bones lay scattered about in the four directions, and the four intermediate directions. 500 carts stood as full as ever. The second story is of a different style. It is told of a young prince who had just completed his military studies under a world-renowned teacher. Having received as a symbol of his distinction the title Prince Five Weapons, he accepted the five weapons that his teacher gave him, bowed and, armed with the new weapons, struck out onto the road leading to the city of his father, the king. On the way, he came to a certain forest. People at the mouth of the forest warned him, "Sir Prince, do not enter this forest," they said. "An ogre lives here named Sticky Hair. He kills every man he sees." But the prince was confident and fearless as a maned lion. He entered the forest just the same. When he reached the heart of it, the ogre showed himself. The ogre had increased his stature to the height of a palm tree. He had created for himself a head as big as a summer house with bell-shaped pinnacle, eyes as big as alms bowls, two tusks as big as giant bulbs or buds. He had the beak of a hawk. His belly was covered with blotches. His hands and feet were dark green. "Where are you going?" he demanded. "Halt! You are my prey." Prince Five Weapons answered without fear, but with great confidence in the arts and crafts that he had learned. "Ogre," said he, "I knew what I was about when I entered this forest. You would do well to be careful about attacking me, for with an arrow steeped in poison will I pierce your flesh and fell you on the spot." Having thus threatened the ogre, the young prince fitted to his bow an arrow steeped in deadly poison and let fly. It stuck right in the ogre's hair. Then he let fly, one after another, 50 arrows. All stuck right to the ogre's hair. The ogre shook off every one of those arrows, letting them fall right at his feet, and approached the young prince. Prince Five Weapons threatened the ogre a second time, and, drawing his sword, delivered a masterly blow. The sword, 33 inches long, stuck right to the ogre's hair. Then the prince smote him with a spear. That also stuck right to his hair. Perceiving that the spear had stuck, he smote him with a club. That also stuck right to his hair. When he saw that the club had stuck, he said, "Master Ogre, you have never heard of me before. I am Prince Five Weapons. When I entered this forest infested by you, I took no account of bows and such like weapons. When I entered this forest, I took account only of myself. Now I am going to beat you and pound you into powder and dust." Having thus made known his determination, with a yell he struck the ogre with his right hand. His hand stuck right to the ogre's hair. He struck him with his left hand. That also stuck. He struck him with his right foot. That also stuck. He struck him with his left foot. That also stuck. Thought he, "I will beat you with my head and pound you into powder and dust." He struck him with his head. That also stuck right to the ogre's hair. Prince Five Weapons snared 5 times, stuck fast in 5 places, dangled from the ogre's body. But for all that, he was unafraid, undaunted. As for the ogre, he thought, "This is some lion of a man, some man of noble birth, no mere man. For although he has been caught by an ogre like me, he appears neither to tremble nor to quake. In all the time I have harried this road, I have never seen a single man to match him. Why, pray, is he not afraid?" Not daring to eat him, he asked, "Youth, why are you not afraid? Why are you not terrified with the fear of death?" "Ogre, why should I be afraid? For in one life, one death is absolutely certain. What's more, I have in my belly a thunderbolt for a weapon. If you eat me, you will not be able to digest that weapon. It will tear your insides into tatters and fragments and will kill you. In that case, we'll both perish. That's why I'm not afraid." Prince Five Weapons, the reader must know, was referring to the weapon of knowledge that was within him. Indeed, this young hero was none other than the future Buddha in an earlier incarnation.
The thunderbolt, Vajra, is one of the major symbols in Buddhist iconography, signifying the spiritual power of Buddhahood, indestructible enlightenment, which shatters the illusory realities of the world. The absolute, or Adi Buddha, is represented in the images of Tibet as Vajradhara, Tibetan Dorje Chang, holder of the adamantine bolt. In the figures of the gods that have come down from ancient Mesopotamia, Sumer and Akkad, Babylonia and Assyria, the thunderbolt, in the same form as the Vajra, is a conspicuous element. From these, it was inherited by Zeus. We know also that among primitive peoples, warriors may speak of their weapons as thunderbolts. Sicut in caelo et in terra. The initiated warrior is an agent of the divine will. His training is not only in manual, but also in spiritual skills. Magic, the supernatural power of the thunderbolt, as well as physical force and chemical poison, gives the lethal energy to his blows. A consummate master would require no physical weapon at all. The power of his magic word would suffice. The parable of Prince Five Weapons illustrates this theme, but it also teaches that the one who relies or prides himself upon his merely empirical, physical character is already undone. "We have here the picture of a hero," writes Dr. Kumaraswamy, who can be involved in the coils of an aesthetic experience, the five points being the five senses, but is able, by an intrinsic moral superiority, to liberate himself, and even to release others.
"What this youth says is true," thought the ogre, terrified with the fear of death. "From the body of this lion of a man, my stomach would not be able to digest a fragment of flesh, even so small as a kidney bean. I'll let him go." And he let Prince Five Weapons go. The future Buddha preached the doctrine to him, subdued him, made him self-denying, and then transformed him into a spirit entitled to receive offerings in the forest. Having admonished the ogre to be heedful, the youth departed from the forest, and at the mouth of the forest told his story to human beings, then went his way. It has been pointed out that this adventure of Prince Five Weapons is the earliest known example of the celebrated and well-nigh universal Tar Baby story of popular folklore. As a symbol of the world to which the five senses glue us, and which cannot be pressed aside by the actions of the physical organs, Sticky Hair was subdued only when the future Buddha, no longer protected by the five weapons of his momentary name and physical character, resorted to the unnamed invisible sixth, the divine thunderbolt of the knowledge of the transcendent principle, which is beyond the phenomenal realm of names and forms. Therewith the situation changed. He was no longer caught, but released, for that which he now remembered himself to be is ever free. The force of the monster of phenomenality was dispelled, and he was rendered self-denying. Self-denying, he became divine, a spirit entitled to receive offerings, as is the world itself when known, not as final, but as a mere name and form of that which transcends, yet is immanent within, all names and forms. The wall of paradise, which conceals God from human sight, is described by Nicholas of Cusa as constituted of the coincidence of opposites, its gate being guarded by the highest spirit of reason, who bars the way until he has been overcome. The pairs of opposites, being and not being, life and death, beauty and ugliness, good and evil, and all the other polarities that bind the faculties to hope and fear, and link the organs of action to deeds of defense and acquisition, are the clashing rocks, symplegades, that crush the traveler, but between which the heroes always pass. This is a motif known throughout the world. The Greeks associated it with two rocky islands of the Euxine Sea, which clash together, driven by winds. But Jason in the Argo sailed between, and since that time they have stood apart. The twin heroes of the Navajo legend were warned of the same obstacle by Spider Woman, protected, however, by the pollen symbol of the path, and eagle feathers plucked from a living sunbird, they passed between. As the rising smoke of an offering through the sun door, so goes the hero, released from ego, through the walls of the world, leaving ego stuck to Sticky Hair, and passing on. 5. The Belly of the Whale. The idea that the passage of the magical threshold is a transit into a sphere of rebirth is symbolized in the worldwide womb image of the belly of the whale. The hero, instead of conquering or conciliating the power of the threshold, is swallowed into the unknown, and would appear to have died.
Mishinama, king of fishes, in his wrath he darted upward, flashing, leaped into the sunshine, opened his great jaws and swallowed both canoe and Hiawatha. Longfellow, The Song of Hiawatha.
The Eskimo of Bering Strait tell of the trickster hero Raven, how one day, as he sat drying his clothes on a beach, he observed a whale cow swimming gravely close to shore. He called, "Next time you come up for air, dear, open your mouth and shut your eyes." Then he slipped quickly into his raven clothes, pulled on his raven mask, gathered his fire sticks under his arm, and flew out over the water. The whale came up. She did as she had been told. Raven darted through the open jaws and straight into her gullet. The shocked whale cow snapped and sounded. Raven stood inside and looked around. The Zulus have a story of two children and their mother, swallowed by an elephant. When the woman reached the animal's stomach, she saw large forests and great rivers and many high lands. On one side there were many rocks, and there were many people who had built their village there, and many dogs and many cattle, all there inside the elephant. The Irish hero Finn McCool was swallowed by a monster of indefinite form, of the type known to the Celtic world as a paisht. The little German girl, Red Riding Hood, was swallowed by a wolf. The Polynesian favorite Maui was swallowed by his great-great-grandmother, Hina Nui Tepo. And the whole Greek pantheon, with the sole exception of Zeus, was swallowed by its father, Kronos. The Greek hero Heracles, pausing at Troy on his way homeward with the belt of the Queen of the Amazons, found that the city was being harassed by a monster sent against it by the sea god Poseidon. The beast would come ashore and devour people as they moved about on the plain. Beautiful Hesione, the daughter of the king, had just been bound by her father to the sea rocks as a propitiatory sacrifice, and the great visiting hero agreed to rescue her for a price. The monster, in due time, broke to the surface of the water and opened its enormous maw. Heracles took a dive into the throat, cut his way out through the belly, and left the monster dead. This popular motif gives emphasis to the lesson that the passage of the threshold is a form of self-annihilation. Its resemblance to the adventure of the Symplegades is obvious, but here, instead of passing outward, beyond the confines of the visible world, the hero goes inward to be born again. The disappearance corresponds to the passing of a worshipper into the temple, where he is to be quickened by the recollection of who and what he is, namely dust and ashes, unless immortal. The temple interior, the belly of the whale, and the heavenly land beyond, above, and below the confines of the world are one and the same. That is why the approaches of and the entrances to temples are flanked and defended by colossal gargoyles, dragons, lions, devil slayers with drawn swords, resentful dwarves, winged bulls. These are the threshold guardians to ward away all incapable of encountering the higher silence within. They are preliminary embodiments of the dangerous aspect of the presence, corresponding to the mythological ogres that bound the conventional world, or to the two rows of teeth of the whale. They illustrate the fact that the devotee, at the moment of the entry into the temple, undergoes a metamorphosis. His secular character remains without. He sheds it as a snake its slough. Once inside, he may be said to have died to time and returned to the world womb, the world navel, the earthly paradise. The mere fact that anyone can physically walk past the temple guardians does not invalidate their significance. For if the intruder is incapable of encompassing the sanctuary, he has effectually remained without. Anyone unable to understand a god sees it as a devil, and is thus defended from the approach. Allegorically, then, the passage into a temple and the hero dive through the jaws of the whale are identical adventures, both denoting, in the picture language, the life-centering, life-renewing act. No creature, writes Ananda Kumaraswamy, can attain a higher grade of nature without ceasing to exist. Indeed, the physical body of the hero may be actually slain, dismembered, and scattered over the land or sea, as in the Egyptian myth of the savior Osiris. He was thrown into a sarcophagus and committed to the Nile by his brother Set. And when he returned from the dead, his brother slew him again, tore the body into 14 pieces, and scattered these over the land. The sarcophagus or casket is an alternative for the belly of the whale. Compare Moses in the bulrushes. The twin heroes of the Navajo had to pass not only the clashing rocks, but also the reeds that cut the traveler to pieces, the boiling sands that overwhelm him. The hero whose attachment to ego is already a nihilist passes back and forth across the horizons of the world, in and out of the dragon, as readily as a king through all the rooms of his house. And therein lies his power to save, for his passing and returning demonstrate that through all the contraries of phenomenality, the uncreate imperishable remains, and there is nothing to fear. And so it is that, throughout the world, men whose function it has been to make visible on earth the life-fructifying mystery of the slaying of the dragon have enacted upon their own bodies the great symbolic act, scattering their flesh like the body of Osiris for the renovation of the world. In Phrygia, for example, in honor of the crucified and resurrected Savior Attis, a pine tree was cut on the 22nd of March and brought into the sanctuary of the mother goddess Cybele. There it was swathed like a corpse with woolen bands and decked with wreaths of violets. The effigy of a young man was tied to the middle of the stem. Next day took place a ceremonial lament and blowing of trumpets. The 24th of March was known as the Day of Blood. The high priest drew blood from his arms, which he presented as an offering. The lesser clergy whirled in a dervish dance to the sound of drums, horns, flutes, and cymbals until, wrapped in ecstasy, they gashed their bodies with knives to bespatter the altar and tree with their blood. And the novices, in imitation of the god whose death and resurrection they were celebrating, castrated themselves and swooned.
Attis's is the sacrifice that King Minos refused when he withheld the bull from Poseidon. As Fraser has shown, ritual regicide was a general tradition in the ancient world. In southern India, he writes, the king's reign and life terminated with the revolution of the planet Jupiter round the sun. In Greece, on the other hand, the king's fate seems to have hung in the balance at the end of every 8 years. Without being unduly rash, we may surmise that the tribute of 7 youths and 7 maidens, whom the Athenians were bound to send to Minos every 8 years, had some connection with the renewal of the king's power for another octennial cycle. The bull sacrifice required of King Minos implied that he would sacrifice himself, according to the pattern of the inherited tradition, at the close of his 8-year term. But he seems to have offered, instead, the substitute of the Athenian youths and maidens. That, perhaps, is how the divine Minos became the monster Minotaur, the self-annihilate king, the tyrant Holdfast, and the hieratic state, wherein every man enacts his role, the merchant empire, wherein each is out for himself. Such practices of substitution seem to have become general throughout the antique world toward the close of the great period of the early hieratic states, during the 3rd and 2nd millennia BC.
And in the same spirit, the king of the South Indian province of Quilachara, at the completion of the 12th year of his reign, on a day of solemn festival, had a wooden scaffolding constructed and spread over with hangings of silk. When he had ritually bathed in a tank with great ceremonies and to the sound of music, he then came to the temple, where he did worship before the divinity. Thereafter, He mounted the scaffolding and, before the people, took some very sharp knives and began to cut off his own nose, and then his ears, and his lips, and all his members, and as much of his flesh as he was able. He threw it away and round about until so much of his blood was spilled that he began to faint, whereupon he summarily cut his throat. Chapter 2. Initiation. 1. The Road of Trials. Once having traversed the threshold, the hero moves in a dream landscape of curiously fluid, ambiguous forms, where he must survive a succession of trials. This is a favorite phase of the myth adventure. It has produced a world literature of miraculous tests and ordeals. The hero is covertly aided by the advice, amulets, and secret agents of the supernatural helper, whom he met before his entrance into this region. Or it may be that he here discovers for the first time that there is a benign power everywhere supporting him in his superhuman passage. One of the best known and most charming examples of the difficult tasks motif is that of Psyche's quest for her lost lover, Cupid. Here, all the principal roles are reversed. Instead of the lover trying to win his bride, it is the bride trying to win her lover. And instead of a cruel father withholding his daughter from the lover, it is the jealous mother Venus hiding her son, Cupid, from his bride. When Psyche pleaded with Venus, the goddess grasped her violently by the hair and dashed her head upon the ground, then took a great quantity of wheat, barley, millet, poppy seed, peas, lentils, and beans, mingled these all together in a heap, and commanded the girl to sort them before night. Psyche was aided by an army of ants. Venus told her next to gather the golden wool of certain dangerous wild sheep, sharp of horn and poisonous of bite, that inhabited an inaccessible valley in a dangerous wood. But a green reed instructed her how to gather from the reeds round about the golden locks shed by the sheep in their passage. The goddess now required a bottle of water from a freezing spring, high on a towering rock beset by sleepless dragons. An eagle approached and accomplished the marvelous task. Psyche was ordered, finally, to bring from the abyss of the underworld a box full of supernatural beauty. But a high tower told her how to go down to the world below, gave her coins for Charon and sops for Cerberus, and sped her on her way. Psyche's voyage to the underworld is but one of innumerable such adventures undertaken by the heroes of fairy tale and myth. Among the most perilous are those of the shamans of the peoples of the farthest north, the Laps, Siberians, Eskimo, and certain American Indian tribes, when they go to seek out and recover the lost or abducted souls of the sick. The shaman of the Siberians is clothed for the adventure in a magical costume representing a bird or reindeer, the shadow principle of the shaman himself, the shape of his soul. His drum is his animal, his eagle, reindeer, or horse. He is said to fly or ride on it. The stick that he carries is another of his aids, and he is attended by a host of invisible familiars. An early voyager among the Laps has left a vivid description of the weird performance of one of these strange emissaries into the kingdoms of the dead. Since the yonder world is a place of everlasting night, the ceremonial of the shaman has to take place after dark. The friends and neighbors gather in the flickering, dimly lighted hut of the patient and follow attentively the gesticulations of the magician. First he summons the helping spirits. These arrive, invisible to all but himself. Two women in ceremonial attire, but without belts and wearing linen hoods, a man without hood or belt, and a girl not as yet adult are in attendance. The shaman uncovers his head, loosens his belt and shoestrings, covers his face with his hands, and begins to twirl in a variety of circles. Suddenly, with very violent gestures, he shouts, "Fit out the reindeer! Ready to boat!" Snatching up an axe, he begins striking himself about the knees with it and swinging it in the direction of the three women. He drags burning logs out of the fire with his naked hands. He dashes three times around each of the women and finally collapses like a dead man. During the whole time, no one has been permitted to touch him. While he reposes now in trance, he is to be watched so closely that not even a fly may settle upon him. His spirit has departed, and he is viewing the sacred mountains with their inhabiting gods. The women in attendance whisper to each other, trying to guess in what part of the yonder world he now may be.
The women may be unable to locate the shaman's position in the yonder world, in which case his spirit may fail to return to the body. Or the wandering spirit of an enemy shaman may engage him in battle, or else lead him astray. It is said that there have been many shamans who failed to return.
If they mention the correct mountain, the shaman stirs either a hand or a foot. At length, he begins to return. In a low, weak voice, he utters the words he has heard in the world below. Then the women begin to sing. The shaman slowly awakes, declaring both the cause of the illness and the manner of sacrifice to be made. Then he announces the length of time it will take for the patient to grow well. Another observer reports,
"On his laborious journey, the shaman has to encounter and master a number of differing obstacles, budak, which are not always easily overcome. After he has wandered through dark forests and over massive ranges of mountains, where he occasionally comes across the bones of other shamans and their animal mounts who have died along the way, he reaches an opening in the ground. The most difficult stages of the adventure now begin, when the depths of the underworld, with their remarkable manifestations, open before him. After he has appeased the watchers of the kingdom of the dead and made his way past the numerous perils, he comes at last to the lord of the underworld, Erlik himself, and the latter rushes against him, horribly bellowing. But if the shaman is sufficiently skillful, he can soothe the monster back again, with promises of luxurious offerings. This moment of the dialogue with Erlik is the crisis of the ceremonial. The shaman passes into an ecstasy."
In every primitive tribe, writes Dr. Geza Roheim, we find the medicine man in the center of society, and it is easy to show that the medicine man is either a neurotic or a psychotic, or at least that his art is based on the same mechanisms as a neurosis or a psychosis. Human groups are actuated by their group ideals, and these are always based on the infantile situation. The infancy situation is modified or inverted by the process of maturation, again modified by the necessary adjustment to reality, yet it is there and supplies those unseen libidinal ties without which no human groups could exist. The medicine men, therefore, are simply making both visible and public the systems of symbolic fantasy that are present in the psyche of every adult member of their society. They are the leaders in this infantile game and the lightning conductors of common anxiety. They fight the demons so that others can hunt the prey, and in general, fight reality. And so it happens that if anyone, in whatever society, undertakes for himself the perilous journey into the darkness by descending, either intentionally or unintentionally, into the crooked lanes of his own spiritual labyrinth, he soon finds himself in a landscape of symbolical figures, any one of which may swallow him, which is no less marvelous than the wild Siberian world of the Pudak and sacred mountains. In the vocabulary of the mystics, This is the second stage of the way, that of the purification of the self, when the senses are cleansed and humbled, and the energies and interests concentrated upon transcendental things. Or in a vocabulary of more modern turn, this is the process of dissolving, transcending, or transmuting the infantile images of our personal past. In our dreams, the ageless perils, gargoyles, trials, secret helpers, and instructive figures are nightly still encountered. And in their forms, we may see reflected not only the whole picture of our present case, but also the clue to what we must do to be saved. I stood before a dark cave wanting to go in, was the dream of a patient at the beginning of his analysis, and I shuddered at the thought that I might not be able to find my way back. I saw one beast after another, Emanuel Swedenborg recorded in his dream book for the night of October 19th to 20th, 1744, and they spread their wings and were dragons. I was flying over them, but one of them was supporting me.
Swedenborg's own comment on this dream was as follows. Dragons of this kind, which do not reveal themselves as dragons until one sees their wings, symbolize false love. I am just now writing on this subject.
And the dramatist Friedrich Hebbel recorded a century later, April 13th, 1844, In my dream I was being drawn with great force through the sea. There were terrifying abysses with here and there a rock to which it was possible to hold. Themistocles dreamed that a snake wound itself around his body, then crept up to his neck, and when it touched his face, became an eagle that took him in its talons and, carrying him upward, bore him a long distance and set him down on a golden herald's staff that suddenly appeared, so safely that he was all at once relieved of his great anxiety and fear. The specific psychological difficulties of the dreamer frequently are revealed with touching simplicity and force. I had to climb a mountain. There were all kinds of obstacles in the way. I had now to jump over a ditch, now to get over a hedge, and finally to stand still because I had lost my breath. This was the dream of a stutterer. I stood beside a lake that appeared to be completely still. A storm came up abruptly, and high waves arose, so that my whole face was splashed. The dream of a girl afraid of blushing, erythrophobia, whose face, when she blushed, would become wet with perspiration. I was following a girl who was going ahead of me along the dark street. I could see her from behind only, and admired her beautiful figure. A mighty desire seized me, and I was running after her. Suddenly a beam, as though released from a spring, came across the street and blocked the way. I awoke with my heart pounding. The patient was a homosexual. The transverse beam, a phallic symbol. I got into a car but did not know how to drive. A man who sat behind me gave me instructions. Finally, things were going quite well, and we came to a plaza where there were a number of women standing. The mother of my fiancé received me with great joy. The man was impotent, but had found an instructor in the psychoanalyst. A stone had broken my windshield. I was now open to the storm and rain. Tears came to my eyes. Could I ever reach my destination in this car? The dreamer was a young woman who had lost her virginity and could not get over it. I saw half of a horse lying on the ground. It had only one wing and was trying to arise, but was unable to do so. The patient was a poet who had to earn his daily bread by working as a journalist. I was bitten by an infant. The dreamer was suffering from a psychosexual infantilism. I am locked with my brother in a dark room. He has a large knife in his hand. I am afraid of him. You will drive me crazy and bring me to the madhouse, I tell him. He laughs with malicious pleasure, replying, "You will always be caught with me. A chain is wrapped around the two of us." I glanced at my legs and noticed for the first time the thick iron chain that bound together my brother and myself. The brother, comments Dr. Stekel, was the patient's illness. "I am going over a narrow bridge," dreams a 16-year-old girl. "Suddenly it breaks under me, and I plunge into the water. An officer dives in after me and brings me, with his strong arms, to the bank. Suddenly it seems to me, then, that I am a dead body. The officer, too, looks very pale, like a corpse."
"Naturally," writes Dr. Stekel, "to be dead here means to be alive. She begins to live, and the officer lives with her. They die together. This throws a glaring light on the popular fantasy of the double suicide. It should be noted also that this dream includes the well-nigh universal mythological image of the sword bridge, which appears in the romance of Lancelot's rescue of Queen Guinevere from the castle of King Death.
The dreamer is absolutely abandoned and alone in a deep hole of a cellar. The walls of his room keep getting narrower and narrower so that he cannot stir. In this image are combined the ideas of mother womb, imprisonment, cell, and grave. I am dreaming that I have to go through endless corridors. Then I remain for a long time in a little room that looks like the bathing pool in the public baths. They compel me to leave the pool, and I have to pass again through a moist, slippery shaft until I come through a little latticed door into the open. I feel like one newly born, and I think, this means a spiritual rebirth for me, through my analysis. There can be no question. The psychological dangers through which earlier generations were guided by the symbols and spiritual exercises of their mythological and religious inheritance, we today, insofar as we are unbelievers, or, if believers, insofar as our inherited beliefs fail to represent the real problems of contemporary life, must face alone, or at best with only tentative, impromptu, and not often very effective guidance. This is our problem as modern, enlightened individuals, for whom all gods and devils have been rationalized out of existence. Nevertheless, in the multitude of myths and legends that have been preserved to us or collected from the ends of the earth, we may yet see delineated something of our still human course. To hear and profit, however, one may have to submit somehow to purgation and surrender. And that is part of our problem. Just how to do that? Or do ye think that ye shall enter the garden of bliss without such trials as came to those who passed away before you?
The problem is not new, writes Dr. C.G. Jung, for all ages before us have believed in gods in some form or other. Only an unparalleled impoverishment of symbolism could enable us to rediscover the gods as psychic factors, that is, as archetypes of the unconscious. Heaven has become for us the cosmic space of the physicists, and the divine empyrean a fair memory of things that once were. But the heart glows, and a secret unrest gnaws at the roots of our being.
The oldest recorded account of the passage through the gates of metamorphosis is the Sumerian myth of the goddess Inanna's descent to the netherworld.
From the Great Above, she set her mind toward the great below. The goddess, from the great above, she set her mind toward the great below. Inanna, from the great above, she set her mind toward the great below. My lady abandoned heaven, abandoned